You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded in the evening of the 17th of August, 2024. I'm going to get right into it. We're going to talk today about something. Every once in a while, this comes up, not just people communicating with me, but it's always coming up in articles and books. And I've never dealt with it as a specific topic. I've always dealt with it as a corollary to something else. And that's Joseph Stalin's theoretical views, his written views, on what he calls the national question. And this is extremely important because this was his initial role in the Bolshevik government. I'm going to be using two major relatively early pieces. The big one is Marxism and the National Question, which was a book that came out in 1913 that laid out in fairly crude terms what he's talking about by a nation and what this has to do with Soviet policy. And then in November of 1918, the Soviet government and, or I should say the October Revolution and the National Question. Because this is not that long after his friends took over the state. Marxism and the National Question is organized fairly rationally. It's basically coherent. It's certainly not meant for academics. Joseph Stalin was not a scholar. It's laid out for this middle strata of educated but non-academic readers. It's sort of a form of propaganda. And the reason I'm doing this, we could talk about his policy, and we've done that many times, but what he thought his policy was grounded in and how he functions theoretically in his written work, which is massive, between his esoteric and exoteric points of view, how radically the theory deviated from eventual policy. And in fact, he justifies that to some extent in these written works. Now, he has a lot of other essays and speeches on the national question, but more or less they're saying the same thing. Now, this is pretty fundamental because the Soviet Union was a union. Ideally, it was supposed to be autonomous, liberated nations around a Russian core that was mercilessly exploited. Its cultural manifestations were banned, but the only reason that the exterior republics were permitted to function was purely symbolically, or to keep them in the Union, keep them producing. The farther away from Moscow you were, sometimes the better off you were. They went back and forth on the Ukrainian issue, for example. So Stalin begins by trying to define what a nation is, and that's a very difficult thing to do for people who are much better off in this respect than Stalin. At a minimum, and we'll see throughout this, that he doesn't really use a stable definition. He comes up with one that is, I guess, workable. Sometimes it's connected with Marxism, sometimes it isn't. But he starts off with something very simple. You refer to a nation, you are talking about primarily a community, but not just any community. A definite and specific community, and strangely he adds of people, we're not talking about animals, so. But then he says, it's not tribal, nor it's racial, nor is it racial. He says, for example, that the modern Italian nation, of course, 1913, was formed from a substantial group of people. Greeks, Arabs, Romans, Teutons. Now, that may be somewhat of an exaggeration, but it's not crazy to say that these influences coalesced in the idea of the Italian. Some of these groups had a greater impact than others. And he says the same thing about the French, and he's on more solid ground here. Gauls, Romans, Britons, Teutons, etc. And the status, however, of these other peoples that were too small by themselves to be a nation, but found it in their interests to be a part of something larger. The claim is, of course, that our ethnic groups were formed from much smaller tribal organizations, which isn't saying very much, because a tribe is really not capable of functioning on its own. It must be a part of something greater. So the only thing that Stalin rests on, then, given that fact, is that a nation is not racial or tribal, but it's historically constituted. And that becomes extremely important, what historically constituted actually means. It's not anything genetic, it's nothing etched in stone. There's no natural law here. It's simply random groups of influences that create nation X, but it may be nation Y in a certain period of time. Then he says something, you know, again, more solid ground, that the great empires, he's talking about Cyrus or Alexander, you can't talk about an empire as a nation, and that's true. An empire is formed out of nations. Unlike tribes, generally speaking, nations didn't dissolve. There was never really any empire-wide identity. And, of course, that differs depending on where you are. But ethnic groups maintain their specificity, and it was in their interest, in one way or another, to be a part of a much larger organization. Military units tended to be divided that way. There was no conception of integration or anything else like that, except possibly in certain circumstances over time. No one calls an empire a nation. But the relation between a tribe and an ethnic group on the one hand, and an ethnic group or nation and an empire on the other, are very different from each other. And Stalin is correct to say that they're not nations, these empires, but they're loosely connected conglomerations or confederations of these groups. And they fell apart or they joined together, depending on the victory or the defeat of whoever was running the show at the time. Now, this requires specialized understanding. You focus on, you know, a group of empires and how the ethnic principle worked, how it waxed and waned. It's going to be different in each case, but the general principle remains. From this, Stalin concludes that a nation is not ephemeral, it's not casual. You know, it's not like, you know, people who like football form a community, people on Facebook form a community because they like knitting. That's not what we're talking about. That community is highly dependent. But it is a stable community of people historically constituted. However, you can talk about a stable community that does not, in fact, constitute a nation. And he goes back to the empire idea. Now, he gets a little controversial. He says, well, Austria and Russia, again, this is prior to World War I, Austria and Russia are stable communities, but no one calls them nations. I would have a tough time calling them communities either. There is an Austrian nation. There certainly is a Russian nation, but he's mixing up the concept of a nation and an empire. What distinguishes a national community from a state? Well, among other things, The nation is inconceivable, as I've said 100 times before, without a common language. But a state doesn't have to have a common language. And that's the odd one. Because for all of the ethnicities that were a part of, say, Byzantium or West Rome, the common language was in the state apparatus. And in the Austrian Empire, German was the lingua franca in the capital. So he says the Czech nation, for example, in the Austrian Empire, and the Polish in the Russian Empire, wouldn't even make sense if each didn't have a common language. Well, that's not saying anything. In fact, he already said that. But the integrity of these empires, he claims, is not affected by the fact that there are a number of different languages within their borders, which clashes with the idea that there has to be, and Stalin doesn't accept this, a lingua franca at the central and bureaucratic levels, or nothing could get done. But he does clarify. He says, I'm not talking about the spoken languages of the people. I'm sorry, he's talking about the spoken languages of the common run of people, not official government languages. So now he's just muddied the waters. But a nation, and of course there's a Russian nation, but there's a difference between a nation and an empire. A common language, therefore, is one of the characteristic features of a nation. He doesn't get into the issue any further, but I've said before that a language, we're not just talking about words and grammar. We're talking about all forms of cultural communication. Everything that is, anything that communicates an idea, everything from gestures to symbols, is part of a national language. But it doesn't mean, in Stalin's world, that different nations have always, or that different nations speak different languages everywhere, or that all who speak one language necessarily constitute one nation. And that requires a bit of explanation. A nation has to have a common language. That doesn't necessarily mean that different languages have to be in a one-to-one ratio with different nations, and that's certainly true. There's nations that speak English, although, of course, they're tied very closely to one another, with the exception of the colonial empire. And sometimes that version of English is incomprehensible to someone from London or Washington. There is no nation which at one and the same time speaks several languages. But you can have two nations speaking the same or similar language, especially when they're separated by a long distance. Englishmen and Americans speak more or less one language, but they don't constitute one nation. Well, that implies that the United States is a nation. England certainly is. The U.S. was founded as a confederation. And he says the same is true from the Norwegians, the Danes, and the English, and the Irish. English and Irish is a little bit controversial, because English was something imposed on the Irish, but that's, you know, we can't get into that here. Now, what does Stalin say? He asks a simple question. If Britain and the U.S. are not one nation, and we could argue over that, you know, we could just assume right now that that's true. They're two separate nations. How can they be two separate nations speaking a common language? And first of all, there's two different definitions of language going on here. But his answer is not a bad one, because they don't live together. Their territories not only are different, but they're quite far from each other. And here's something that's absolutely correct. I'm going to quote him directly here. A nation is formed only as a result of lengthy and systematic intercourse, as a result of people living together generation after generation. But people cannot live together for lengthy periods unless they have a common territory. So you have two variables. The nature of the intercourse has to be based on language. That's what intercourse is. Socially speaking, but the territory is important. This is going to be an issue when he gets to his critique of Otto Bauer. But prior to the settlement of America, their forefathers did inhabit the same territory, you know, Britain. and constituted a one nation. A section of that split off and emigrated to the new territory in America, and in the course of time, it came to form an American nation. Well, in terms of the founding stock, that might be defensible. But over time, waves of immigration, both from Europe and elsewhere, that became more difficult to defend. Then he says, difference of territory led to the formation of different nations. He says then, you know, he concludes the obvious statement that a common territory is one of the characteristic features of a nation. And most of the time, I think that's true. The point being that, especially when you're talking about such a long distance, maybe the relationship between Americans, you know, the founding stock of, you know, Germanic and Anglo background, maybe Irish background, etc. We have a special relationship to Britain because of the language issue, because of, and the intercourse. When he means, he doesn't explain what he means by systematic. I think I understand. They're talking about daily back and forth, not just trade relations that are formalized by a contract. It's people who are regularly seeing one another and form a division of labor. I'm willing to go that far with him. Now, the broader point is that none of these things by themselves create a nation. The common language comes the closest. Again, I define it in a very broad sense. But beyond all that, there is, and I think I already hinted at this, this internal economic bond, the nation into a single whole. We're talking about the division of labor. This is very important. Of course, it can't happen without a common language. This is where territory and distance really matter. This is one of the big reasons that Britain and America constitute two different nations. But the U.S., given its size, would not be a nation. For example, the different parts of the country were not bound together into an economic whole. I don't know if I'd go so, you know, the Confederate States, had they succeeded in being independent, and if there was a lot of bad blood between the two sections, economic intercourse is, of course, you know, there's nothing you could do about it. It's like China and Taiwan. There's been illegal multi-billion-dollar trade there for a long time. It's not really illegal anymore. But it is conceivable that the two sections, rather than what happened after 1865, melding by force into one cosmopolitan entity, they may have looked inward. The accents would have become very different. They would have become far stronger. And economic systematic intercourse, the division of labor, may have been internal, not joining the two, or there'd be some middle ground there. It's like Russia and Ukraine. Do Southerners, you know, in 1850, constitute a separate nation? It's really hard to answer that when you're speaking from 2024 America. Now, here's when he gets to an example. He wants to talk about his own Georgian people. Prior to 1861, Stalin says Georgians inhabited a common territory and spoke one language. Now he says, though, this doesn't mean, strictly speaking, they constituted a single nation, because the state that unified them all didn't exist. They were split up into a number of what he calls disconnected principalities. He assumes that they did not or could not share in the division of labor. They couldn't share a common economic life, that they waged war against each other. They may have even pillaged each other, inciting the Persians or the Turks against their opponents. But of course, nations have been doing that for a very long time. That doesn't vitiate the nation. It just means people are, you know, can be evil. So this is a bit of an exaggeration. The territory and language, the fact that they were being manipulated by, according to him anyway, unscrupulous rulers doesn't vitiate the nation at all. And I'm not certain that the economy, of course, would be a very crude division of labor, didn't exist in one way or another. I don't know how the trading worked in this era in Georgian history. But then he gets into a Marxist mode, which he's not in all the time. Georgia became a nation, according to him, only in the second half or even later in the 19th century. You can't have a nation under serfdom, according to him. I suppose that's the Marxist point of view. The development of high technology, you know, communication, a telegraph, mass media, in other words, the rise of capitalism, that's, according to him, what introduced a division of labor between different parts and then established a nation. The ethnic principle existed prior to this. Well, there's one of two things happening. Either it brought the nation into existence, but Stalin doesn't say that. But he also does say that at different times. It may have made it more obvious. It may have made it more systematic, but it didn't create it. There's no reason why, even in that more modern circumstance, why unscrupulous rulers couldn't pillage one side or another. In the United States, that's exactly what occurred after 1865. So here he says, this is what happens, for the most part, for all nations when they pass through their, quote, stage of feudalism, which is never very well defined, and have developed capitalism. So he's more or less saying that you need capitalist relations for it to be a nation in any usable sense. A common economic life, economic cohesion, which I think are very vague terms, is one of the characteristic features of a nation. Well, this would deny nationhood to medieval societies. And that's simply just not true. The fact that it wasn't, that the relationship wasn't nearly as systematic as it became, say, in industrialization, but the countries where the nation was strongest were places that did not have great industrialization, Georgia being one of them. But then he goes further. He says, it's not, he actually uses the phrase spiritual complexion. I think he means psychological complexion, which doesn't believe in the spirit whatsoever. So then he, and again, I don't think he's wrong necessarily, but he's very vague in talking about a specific psychological makeup developing from generation to generation, something that you might call a national character. So England and America will become separate nations because of their dissimilar modes of existence, conditions of existence. The psychological aspect of this, the national character, it's intangible. But then, given all of this, you know, this is more or less almost a random Darwinian understanding. It's true that the national character doesn't remain the same from generation to generation. It is modified. But I could say that for me and you, as individuals. Our character does change, maybe not in essence, but certainly in detail. As we grow up, as we mature, as we learn new things, as we get traumatized, as we get zeroed out, as we suffer, as we get sick. That doesn't vitiate the fact I'm still an individual. So the last ingredient that Stalin adds to this mix is that psychological composition, the makeup. Then he says that is it. Therefore, the historical, and I put that in quotes, definition that he's going with is that a nation is a historically constituted, stable community of people formed on the basis of a common language, a common territory, a common economic life, and a psychological makeup manifest in a common culture. However, he says, in good Darwinian fashion, it's subject to the law of change. I don't know what law he means. I guess he means dialectics. And it has a history, meaning that it has a beginning and an end, which in and of itself isn't too too awful, but I think he means something different than I do. The biggest takeaway here is that any national movement, now ethnic movements existed long before industrialization. I've spent a lot of time talking about the development of the Ukrainian idea in the religious battles with the Unia and the Poles in the 16th and 17th centuries. Industry had nothing to do with this. Mass media had nothing to do with this. Yeah, of course it was an intellectual matter. So what? Most things usually are. But then he says something that's going to really matter later. National movements are bourgeois movements. Now, what he means by the bourgeoisie or a bourgeois outlook is one of the things that in my book in the Soviet Union, I say they deliberately never quite define. That this is bound up with the fate of the bourgeoisie. In other words, I don't think Stalin read or understood Hegel at all. But what Hegel said, it really is in modernity and the formation of the state, not that created the nation, but that gave it a certain systematic form. And then he says this, the final disappearance of a national movement is possible only with the downfall of the bourgeoisie. In other words, everything that he just spent time explaining exists because of the drive of, I guess, the property elites. Little does he know that the big capitalists were always international, were always opposed to nationally based economic policies. We talk about the Italian city-states in this respect. But then he says something, it seems like there are two different essays here. Only under socialism, and I guess he means Bolshevism, only then can peace be fully established. Even within the framework of capitalism, it's possible to reduce the national struggle to a minimum. Well, Karl Marx was very clear. Marx said that free trade, that essentially is what capitalism is, in his mind, internationally speaking, that free trade is necessary to revolution because revolution can't occur until these nations are reduced to more or less, I don't want to say carbon copies of each other, but more or less standardized. That their elites become so used to what we would call, you know, jet setters and the cocaine in the 80s, that type of guy, that they have no connection to their home country anymore. This is what free trade creates, a merchant class. That's revolutionary. Capitalism is every bit as revolutionary as socialism or Bolshevism ever was. But national struggles, for better or for worse, harm the proletariat. Again, not really defined. I think, depending on the context, he's referring to urban non-property holders. And urban is important because they become denationalized there for the most part. Not always, but that's kind of the old Marxist idea. Okay. Then he goes into the next section of this very, very important book. Here's where the distinction between esso and exoteric doctrines become pretty blatant. And I'm pretty sure he means it this way. Most of you know that in the Soviet various Soviet constitutions and Soviet political thought on, you know, things written on paper, there's this abstract doctrine that every republic in the Soviet Union has the right to secede. And this is the foundation of this point of view. Stalin writes, this is the beginning of section 3 in his very, very important book on the topic. A nation, what he just defined, has the right to freely determine its own destiny. It has the right to arrange its life as it sees fit, without, of course, trampling on the rights of other nations. That is beyond dispute. Now, from here on in, Stalin is going to whittle away at that concept by saying things like, well, how should it arrange its own life then? What form should its future constitution take if the interests of the majority of the nation, and above all the proletariat, are to be borne in mind? With that question, he's completely nullified the idea that a nation has the right freely to determine its own destiny. He doesn't mean a syllable of that. Because if the quote-unquote majority, which was never the case anywhere, that there's a majority of people who want to be a part of a Bolshevist state, it's a majority if the majority of the old population is destroyed. I suppose that would work. That's the old Maoist idea that the masses, quote-unquote masses, this faceless blob entity, once it's purged, it then becomes the people. The people doesn't, the concept of the people does not refer to anyone who's anti-communist. They're not people. The people, when he refers to the people, he's referring only to his movement. But someone who doesn't know that reading it thinks he's some sort of a Democrat. Then, the following line, a nation has the right to arrange its life on autonomous lines. Now, that's very different from just a few lines up. A nation has a right freely to determine its own destiny. Yes, you know, he says it has a right to secede, but that doesn't mean it should. Or at least, it doesn't mean it should under all circumstances. He says, not under all circumstances where autonomy or separation everywhere and always be advantageous to a nation. That is to say, for what he considers its majority. We know what the word Bolshevik means. For the toiling strata. You can't really be a toiler unless you in some way support the Bolshevik takeover. Here is where it gets interesting. He uses the example of the Tartars of Transcaucasia. He says, the Tartars as a nation may assemble, let us say, in their parliament and succumbing to the influence of their beys and mullahs, decide to restore the old order of things and to secede from the state. And I think he means the USSR. All of a sudden, in Stalin's mind, freely disposing of its own destiny is now out the window. So Soviet policy isn't just some contradiction. He says it right here. Now, Stalin says, and I'm quoting here, according to the meaning of the clause on self-determination, they are fully entitled to secede. But will it be in the interests of the toiling strata or the workers of the Tartar nation? Can social democracy look on indifferently when the beys and mullahs assume the leadership of the masses in the solution of the national question? Should not social democracy, and by social democracy he's referring to socialism, Bolshevism, any that movement, should not social democracy interfere in the matter and influence the will of the nation in a definite way? Should it not come forward with a definite plan for a solution to the question, a plan which would be most advantageous to the Tartar masses? The use of the word masses, I've always hated that. Lots of leftists use it all the time. We've spoken of mass society. We've spoken of Ortega Gasset's book. We've talked about even Michael Oakeshott's essay on the topic, mass society and what that means. It's not a good thing. Masses aren't made up of individuals. A mass is just a blob of power that can, in fact, has to be manipulated by a vanguard party. Now, here's how Stalin covers it up. Of course, what he's saying is, if our enemies take over, they're not going anywhere. By beys and mullahs, bey meaning a landowner, mullah meaning a religious leader, if they, no matter how popular they've become, that by definition can't be in the interests of the various laboring classes in the Tartar state, Tartar republics. And therefore, social democracy, he uses that odd term, so as almost to take attention away from, you know, Soviet force. Of course, this is before the Soviet Union was established, but that means he's known this in advance. Social democracy, meaning the party, meaning the state that the party runs, should intervene, destroy the mullahs and the beys, because that's what's most advantageous for the Tartar masses. So But as a way to backtrack, and not so much to backtrack, but to cover this up, he says, all of these problems, I'm sorry, all of these are problems, the solution of which will depend on the concrete historical conditions in which the given nation finds itself. More than that, conditions, like everything else, they change. And a decision which is correct at one particular time may prove to be entirely unsuitable at another. At this point, you have to be a moron not to realize what he means here. Historical conditions, the minute he starts talking in the abstract, a nation is not abstract. He says so, and he's right about that. The only thing that really matters is whether or not it's advantageous to Soviet power, which is really what he means by the toiling masses, because the leadership of the toiling masses, by definition, is Soviet power. So Stalin may, and I've read a lot of American communist propaganda in the 30s and 40s, and they say, no, this isn't some centralized state. No, the Constitution, Stalin's own writings, he says that nations have every right to secede, to establish themselves. He believes in full self-determination. But then he says something like this. Historical conditions, in his mind, is, and he could use the toiling masses or workers or proletariat, whatever abstraction he wants to use, their interests is very easily translated into the interests of Soviet power, which at the time of this writing hadn't been established, but he doesn't ever take this back. 1918 on, he says the same thing when he takes over as Minister for Nationalities. None of this ever changes. And he gives an example, and it says more than I think he wants to say. In the middle of the 19th century, Marx was in favor of the secession of Russian Poland, and he was right. For it was then a question of emancipating a higher culture from a lower one that was destroying it. And the question at that time was not only a theoretical one, an academic question, but a practical one, a question of actual reality. Now, he says quite a bit here. First of all, in his bitter hatred of all things Russian, he makes the claim that Russia is a lower culture, a barbaric one, as Marx himself said, and the Polish only because it's more Western or Westernized, and heavily Jewish, as we know, is a superior culture. But that is not why Karl Marx wanted secession. All he cared about was weakening Russia, weakening the Russian Empire, which he and most of the leftists said throughout the International was the bulwark against revolution. At the end of the 19th century, Polish Marxists, which were, almost entirely Jewish, were already declaring against the secession of Poland. And they too were right. For during the 50 years, that interim, that elapsed, profound changes had taken place, bringing Russia and Poland closer economically and culturally. Moreover, during that period, the question of secession had been converted from a practical matter into a matter of academic dispute, which excited nobody except perhaps intellectuals abroad. Well, as you get closer and closer to the establishment of Soviet power, as people began to, for example, in 1905, where it seemed that the royal authority was waning, now you want to stick as close as you can. Karl Marx did not say that Russia is a bad place for revolution, except that it was a lower culture, according to him, in this hierarchy. Again, one of the many things that he had in common with the capitalists. He did say in his letter to Vera Zasulich that the peasant commune, etc., actually had a good, was a good foundation. Plus, Russia was industrializing quickly. So that's not the issue. It's whether or not Russian power should be strengthened. And very rare did anyone think the Russian power should be strengthened. But another reason that the International rejected secession is that you had a number of revolutionaries entering into Russian space via Poland. It was a heavily Jewish part of the Russian Empire, and therefore secession may be a big problem. Once it became a part of the Warsaw Pact generations later, then secession was absolutely out of the question. So again, he repeats, the solution is only possible with the historical conditions taken in their development. In other words, what serves the interests of the international, or later on, the establishment of Soviet power. So it's the economic and cultural specificities of a nation. And that's how you come to understand how a society should arrange its life, via the Constitution or any other way. Now, he does criticize the Jewish Bund. He has a whole section on that, which doesn't say much. We're going to talk about Bauer and Springer and people like that here in a second. But there was some distrust over this constant desire of the Jews to be separate, even from their own revolutionary movement. If you go to my talk on Bit of Bizdan, you'll see that same thing comes up again. And he goes into a criticism of people like Bauer. Now, if you go back years ago in my archives at Radio Albion, I have a lecture on Bauer and what's called Austro-Marxism. It's a very specific form of National Socialism, left National Socialism, which I always thought was very intriguing, and I don't spend enough time on it. And he goes into their, and it's not just the Bund, the Jewish Bund, but many others as well, that and the conferences, the conference at Brunn in 1899, where the Social Democrats of Austria got together, the word, you know, if anybody had an ethnic problem, Austrians did. But the Bund was active there as well. And so Stalin spends some time criticizing Bauer's, for lack of a better phrase, almost a national Bolshevism, a national Marxism, maybe, a variation of National Socialism. And this was called the South Slav Social Democratic Party. And Stalin says that this approaches the question in an entirely non-Russian way. It's hard to tell whether people like, you remember the Balkan Wars were raging, and hence Austria was involved. Did Stalin believe that you know, the Austrian Empire was on its last legs? Very, very possibly. But he talks about the national program at Brunn in 1899 with Springer and Bauer as the leaders. And here's what Springer says, and this I'm quoting this directly from Stalin, but this is his quote of Springer at the Austrian conference. Whether a multinational state is possible, whether in particular the various Austrian nationalities are obliged to form a single political entity, this is a question we will not answer here, but we shall assume it to be settled. For anyone who will not concede this possibility and necessity, our investigation will, of course, be purposeless. Our theme is as follows. Inasmuch as these nations are obligated to live together, what legal forms will enable them to live together in the best possible way? Otto Bauer says the same thing. We therefore start from the assumption that the Austrian nations will remain in the same state union in which they exist at present, and inquire how the nations within this union will arrange their relations among themselves and to the state. Again, this is 1899. As far as the Bolsheviks were concerned, revolution was growing. It needed a spark, and that spark, as we all know, was World War I, not too long afterwards. Stalin is angry because Russia was the bulwark against revolution. The other one, although less stable, was the Austrian Empire at Vienna. When these guys refer to the Austrian nations, they mean Austria as an empire, not as part of the German ethnic group. And Stalin is very upset that the integrity of the Austrian Empire is to remain in their minds. Then all of a sudden, he goes back to the concept of self-determination. When it comes to a non or very anti-communist empire like the Austrian, all of a sudden now secession in his mind becomes an integral right. And the Jewish Bund had something to do with this. The Jewish Bund, one of its spokesmen, Goldblatt, said this. Nothing here can be said against the right of self-determination. If any nation is striving for independence, we must not oppose it. If Poland does not wish to enter into the lawful wedlock with Russia, it is not for us to interfere with her. Now, Stalin says that might be true as far as it goes, but that conditions, quote-unquote conditions, in Austria and the Russian Empire are very different from one another. So whether Bauer is right or wrong isn't relevant to what in the future will be the Soviet Union. The Austro-Marxists were hardly Marxists at all. They did have a very coherent form of National Socialism that really wasn't revolutionary in the sense there wasn't going to be this huge Bolshevik onslaught. It's a cultural national autonomy, which Stalin wants to claim is very different from self-determination. Now, the Russian Marxist, quote-unquote, and he's referring to the heavily Jewish, almost a Russo-Polish movement, communist movement, say that, of course, the freedom of nationalities could only be brought about through violent revolution, i.e. the overthrow of the monarchy. Now, it should be noted that Bauer's movement, the Austro-Marxist, did call for the overthrow of the emperor. So they're not that, their nationalism is quote-unquote democratic, not royalist. But Bauer says this, again, same conference. Of course, there's little probability that national autonomy will be the result of a great decision, of a bold action. Austria will develop towards national autonomy step by step by a slow process of development in the course of severe struggle, as a consequence of which legislation and administration will be in a state of chronic paralysis. The new constitution will not be created by a great legislative act, but by a multitude of separate enactments for individual provinces and individual communities. And Springer says the same thing. So as far as nationalism goes, you see a substantial split developing, one of many. Springer says, none of this can be created, like Stalin thought, with one massive explosion of revolution. Springer talks about Prussia. This ethnic administration takes a long time to develop. Prussian administrative institutions take a while. That revolution is not a magic spell. Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, even Marx himself sometimes falls into this. That revolution is not even a political matter. And I've talked about this in some of the Soviet literature that sees revolution as a bizarre magic incantation that's going to completely alter human nature. Bolshevism, of course, and I think when he says quote-unquote Russian Marxists, he means Bolsheviks, the Social Democratic Labor Party. That violent revolution, because the Tsar was so hated. Remember, both the emperor in Vienna and the Tsar in Petersburg were claiming, for different reasons, to be of the political Roman descent, not, in terms of DNA, but in terms of its long political development. Austria and then, Germany, from the old Rome and of course, Moscow. And not so much Petersburg, but Moscow from Byzantium and Bulgaria, Chernobyl. And Stalin is starting to realize that they have followers in Austria. And this is becoming a huge problem. So they're socialists. But they're, I don't want to go too far here, but they're not that far off from National Socialism. And this is before these movements really had coalesced ideologically. Despite the fact that the Austro-Marxists wanted the emperor gone, they did want to increase the role, of course, of parliament. But even under the emperor, even in 1913, as Stalin's writing these words, he says in Austria, the parliamentarist idea prevails. And he's right to say that this is a huge problem. Because in Austria and elsewhere, where parliaments rule, this is where rich people, the upper level of capitalists and bankers. This is where they hash out who's going to get what. And because of the different factions that come into existence, political life becomes a complete standstill. I was with Keith Knight in an interview just a few hours ago with him, and he asked me about the nature of my book on military governments in Latin America, or anywhere else for that matter, but I have a book on the Latin American one. And I say this is where these guys came from. Parliaments, without some external force, tend to do very little. There's too many factions. The rules of procedure are always being manipulated. These are always wealthy people who use their money to manipulate media and everything else to put themselves into office, and they serve these constituents, let alone themselves. But in the third world, although much of Latin America was not third world, like Argentina, the first world European country, it was becoming third world because of the Marxist revolution, because of the drug trade, because of economic collapse, hyperinflation, American interference, and all the rest of it. Parliament was in no position, didn't have the strength to fight back. You needed a strong hand, and it's no accident that most of these military men were of peasant backgrounds. They were not wealthy men. The parliamentarians were. The communists certainly were. They were usually lawyers or something like that. So I think Stalin has a right to be a little skeptical, at least as far as the Brunn Conference in 1899, and nothing had changed by the time he's writing this in 1913. He says, though, that, and he's right, that in Austria, the national question was the dominant one in political life. You have these very self-conscious ethnic groups making up a patchwork of an empire, a very humane one as far as policy goes. But 1848 wasn't that long ago. And he says, well, yeah, so every little nation, every section has its own parliament. So it's no shock that people like Bauer should try to rely on that. And to that extent, Stalin makes a very good point. In 1913, Stalin didn't make the argument. He said, and I'm quoting directly here, in Russia, there is no parliament, thank God. Well, I don't know why Stalin's thanking God. I think this is an expression. The Dumas had more or less come into existence at this point, not in 1899. You did have many parliaments at the local level, but not at any national, what we would call the federal level. And it's not a parliament in the British sense or the Western European sense that had tremendous power over national policy. Stalin then makes the claim that the national question is not nearly as powerful in the Russian Empire as it is in the Austrian. Rather, it's the agrarian issue. And if there's any issue that the Bolsheviks completely misunderstood, deliberately misunderstood, and destroyed, no one in 1913 realized this, of course, but they're going to realize it pretty soon. Now, at least to that extent, this notion of historical specificity is, you know, as far as that goes, I understand. But then he says, our job in the Russian Empire is in the very fact of liberating Russia, liberating others within it, is a solution to the agrarian question, i.e., the destruction of the relics of feudalism. And that's the same as far as Stalin is concerned with the democratization of the country. That's the big issue. Marxists use the word feudal a lot, and essentially it means anything that's previous to modernity. Otto Bauer, in these debates, years before Stalin was writing, that at least in Central Europe, national peace is utterly indispensable for any politics to function whatsoever. National peace will avoid a Latin American military takeover when the parliament is so paralyzed that it can do nothing to save the economy or to wipe the communist revolutionaries off the street, who were killing people with impunity everywhere where the military took over. Bauer says the state cannot permit legislation to be brought to a standstill by the very stupid question of language or by every quarrel between excited people on a linguistic frontier or over every new school, meaning education policy. Now, Section 4 of this famous book, he goes into what the Bauer Austro-Marxist solution actually is. And he makes the distinction between cultural national autonomy from the Austrian point of view and national liberation and self-determination from the Bolshevik point of view. And it's true that the Austro-Marxist National Socialist idea is based on ethnic membership, not necessarily territory. And there's a reason why he made such a big deal about territory in the first section. That it's ethnic membership. It's not so much to a say, Poland with borders, and everyone who lives within it is quote-unquote Polish. It may be mostly Polish, but they're talking about Poles in general. No matter where they're living within the confines of the empire, no matter what part of Austria they may inhabit, autonomy in the Austro-socialist idea is national, not territorial. And there's a certain rationality to this, and I get into this in great detail in my lecture on Bauer and the Austro-Marxist school, or Austro-Socialist school. And I don't even like saying Marxist, because they deviated from him on the national question in many different ways. But in cities, you have a patchwork of ethnic groups. In order to maintain their ethnic connection and hence their cultural integrity, it can't simply be a territory, because you have Czechs, Germans, Poles scattered all over the empire. You take them personally, as families or individuals. They're organized into integral nations, but not on a territorial principle. Austria would then be transformed into not so much a union of autonomous regions, but a union of autonomous nationalities, independent of territory. And that would also imply that national institutions, ethnic institutions, would have to be created for Poles, or Hungarians, Croats, whatever, and then they would have jurisdiction over cultural, linguistic, maybe even religious questions, not so much political ones, though. That would be the Austrian parliament. And that's what the Brünn Congress, 1899, that's what they were concerned with. So the national dissension in Austria was hindering their political life. Their solution was true, what they considered true democracy. Yes, they had universal, direct, and equal suffrage, but on an ethnic basis. And I want to quote from the program itself. The preservation and development of the national specificities of the peoples of Austria is possible only on the basis of equal rights and by avoiding all oppression. Hence, all bureaucratic state centralism and the feudal privileges of individual provinces must first be rejected. Under these conditions, and only under these conditions, will it be possible to establish national order in Austria in place of national dissension, namely on the following four principles. Number one, Austria must be transformed into a democratic state federation of nationalities, which we've already described. Two, the historical crown provinces must be replaced by nationally delimited self-governing corporations, in each of which legislation and administration shall be entrusted to national parliaments elected on the basis of universal suffrage. Number three, all the self-governing regions of one and the same nation must jointly form a single national union, which shall manage its national affairs on an absolutely autonomous basis. Finally, the rights of national minorities must be guaranteed by a special law passed by the Imperial Diet. So, the starting point here, and this is what Stalin is vehemently criticizing, and I think it's pretty clear as to why, the starting point of national autonomy is the idea of the state as a union of ethnic, as individuals organized into ethnic corporations, without regard to a specific territory. And in urban areas, that this does make some kind of sense. From the socialist point of view, not necessarily a Marxist point of view, but from a socialist point of view, the program is very clear, and it does make sense. In places like Austria, in places that are industrializing, in places that see growing cities, it's increasingly the case that members of a nation don't necessarily live in one compact mass. A place like Georgia, it's true. They are in one mass. Places like Tibet, that's true to a great extent there too. But members, and understand the Jews have an interest in this, this movement, because the Jews are precisely of this sort. That doesn't mean the entire concept is false. He says that a member of any ethnicity, Jewish or otherwise, are interspersed amongst alien national organisms. That sounds very Jewish, and that's how Jews have always understood themselves. However, he also says, that is Bauer says, not Stalin, it's the nature of capitalism to remove people from the countryside into the cities to work in the new factories, to search for a livelihood. But when they enter foreign territory, essentially it is foreign territory, they then become a minority. These groups are made to suffer various disabilities, schools and everything else. And this is where, in the Austro-Marxist school, where national conflicts develop. And that's where the territorial principle then becomes a huge problem. That nationalities, not territories, are what is invested with rights and responsibilities. Nations are identical with ethnic groups. The corporation is something along the lines maybe of a union, a labor union in America. The steel workers are interspersed all over the place. You know, they're not in one compact mass. The broader point, and then actually Springer goes on to say that nationality will be determined by certificates. Every person domiciled in a specific area declares his affiliation, one nationality or another, in that area. And it presumes that the population is going to be divided into these nationalities. Now, this is not merely a Judaic idea. It's a free declaration of adult citizens, and then they are put on a national register that has to be drawn up. So the Germans in nationally homogenous districts and Germans anywhere else, for example, in the national registers, in the dual districts, will constitute the German nation and elect members of a national council. And the same thing for Poles and Czechs and everyone else. It's very interesting. This is how, and I guess this is why it's a socialist matter, that socialism and socialism alone can preserve the nation in a national socialist kind of a way, because only then, the problem with capitalism, any claim to nationalism means the national culture can only be enjoyed by those with money, those with contacts, those who have the free time horn in a factory 20 hours a day. This idea is a revolutionary idea that doesn't require any of the old Bolshevik nonsense. And it's going to make national culture the possession of the entire membership, uniting people within the broader society into one or another national cultural communities. But Bauer goes so far as to say this should be the revolutionary doctrine everywhere, because every place has, for the most part, has some minority group. In other words, it's the demand for national autonomy. This is how the labor movement is going to oppose the property classes. This then becomes the constitutional program of the proletariat in this multinational state. And Stalin rages against this. That Stalin says there is no nation without territory. Well, territory is absolutely necessary for control. He can't deal with the fact that national autonomy has been now redefined completely, according to him anyway, of separate from self-determination. And worse, it presupposes the integrity of the empire. We know what happened in 1918. And of course, you know, Stalin, you know, gets technical. He says, well, what about the irredentist claims over the border ethnic memberships? But according to Bauer, this is going to be the wave of the future everywhere. Now, here's the payoff. Free trade, capitalism, usury, etc., is in the in 1899, 1913, in the process of destroying these ethnic entities. Hence, to empower them doesn't make any sense. The regime has been calling or predicting the death of nationalism for generations and generations and generations. The national culture can't be shared by classes that are so wildly desperate from each other, disparate from each other. The upper classes have no connection to a nation except symbolically. They're internationalists by their very structure. The big industrialists, the big bankers, they've always been international. They're the ones who benefit from colonies and all the rest of it. But that seems to favor Bauer's idea more so than anything that Stalin had to come up with. The class struggle, according to the so-called Orthodox Marxists, the Stalinists, for all of Stalin's nonsense about self-determination, he's saying that the best part, really the presupposition of revolution is that these ethnic groups should be dying as ethnic groups. The proletariat knows no nation. Saying something stupid like you can't, there's no common culture between the big industrialists and workers. Well, that's true. It's just that the big industrialists aren't nationalists. Maybe middle-level people, maybe low, you know, the petite bourgeois, maybe they do. But there's no banking plan. And of course, with especially in Austria, the Jewish power was so dominant. There is nothing there. We talked about this in 1848. The 1848 revolution in Austria almost overthrew the monarchy. Stalin says these ethnic connections are dying. They're dying because Marxists have pointed to class conflict, not national conflict. Then he gets all upset and Stalin says, well, just think of yeah, we're going to preserve national specificities, right? Like the self-flagellation at their Tartar festivals or the Georgian vendetta. Is that what they're talking about? Obviously, that's not what they're talking about, but this is how Stalin starts to think. And that's what he means by a bourgeois nationalist program. The fact that this is a socialist program doesn't really register. Bourgeois is anything that opposes the Bolshevik idea and certainly the internationalist idea. And there's never going to be a time where this concept of national autonomy is ever going to work. Stalin says, and he attacks Bauer from talking about the division of humanity into nationally delimited communities. Stalin said that's refuted by the whole course of development of modern human society. National barriers are being demolished rather than becoming firmer. We know exactly how wrong he is, despite the endless propaganda, whether it be from Bolsheviks, the socialist, or capitalists. Revolution, in the Marxist point of view, is, and this is, I'm quoting Marx directly here, national differences and antagonisms between peoples are daily more and more vanishing. The supremacy of the proletariat will cause them to vanish still faster. In other words, the definition of a nation that Stalin gave, he not for 2 minutes believes. When he took over, the Reds took over, they manipulated these identities for support here and support there. They encouraged nationalism when it suited them. They liquidated it when it did not. Ukraine is a classic example. It doesn't matter anyway because these are internationalists. Stalin and elsewhere in his writings talks about the future single language that the globe will be unified under. He was a nationalist for nothing. This kind of talk is what drove the Jews to Birbizdan. They still needed their Zionist entity somewhere to protect themselves, even from socialist society, leftist socialist society. Stalin already notices that National Socialism has a foothold with people all over the place, and it terrified him. He goes on about what a nation is, only to say that they're dying anyway. Capitalism is saying the exact same thing today. And in America, of course, they're correct. Anyway, I wasn't able to get to a lot of what I have here. I wasn't able to get to the October Revolution and the national question. Maybe we'll do it next week. Maybe I'll put it off for another time. But according to Stalin, destroying the bourgeois order is the same thing as destroying national or religious specificities and connections, rendering people without an identity and hence very easily able to be controlled. Nationalism was something that he could manipulate for control, not actually existing in its own right. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.